Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. Today's guest is Dr. David Spindler, a neuroscientist and cognitive performance specialist. David has worked at the very highest levels across sports from cycling and triathlon to soccer and Formula One, with a list of athletes that includes Ironman World Champions Sam Laidlow and Chelsea Sodaro, Mountain Bike World Champion Katie Courtney, UTMB winner Tom Evans, and 35-time Tour de France stage winner Sir Mark Cavendish, and many others as well. Today, we're talking about cognitive neuroscience and athletic performance, what the brain's role is in how we train, race, recover, and how this applies to amateur triathletes and endurance athletes. David, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. I think I first started hearing about you around the time of Tom Evans' UTMB win, actually, but then I was digging a bit and found some other interviews and the connection with Mark Cavendish. I think you were part of the documentary that was released on Netflix as well with him. So many listeners might have seen you there. But either way, what you're doing is very interesting. So let's start there. What do you actually do?
So I look at how your brain works with your central nervous system to produce performances. That's the easiest way to put it. It's way more complex than that, obviously. But how your thoughts, behaviors, and actions relate to how your nervous system works and produces performance, that's my specialty.
Is it so? If I try to interpret that a bit, and also based on your background, you're using both elements from neuroscience, so more technical aspects of the brain and how it works, with more classical psychology. Is that a fair interpretation?
Yes, I'm not a psychologist at all.
Okay.
So I don't profess to know any of that. Like, there's some brilliant sports psychologists out there. That's something different than what I do. But I look at the actual structural components of the brain and why people act and feel the way they do, and then how that then equates to how they interpret stress in general into their body, and then how that then can change the delivery of performance on any given day.
So can you walk us through that in a bit more detail, and maybe also illustrate with some examples of the things that are easy to understand for the listeners, that this is an example of how the brain is connected with athletic performance, and maybe even an intervention that you would advise athletes use to work on that particular component.
Okay, so if we just look at the brain and the body is one system. It's not two, what people think, or what traditionally has been the role of overall sports performance. It's really mainly physiology, and then the brain comes after that. But the brain plays a central role in athletic performance because it regulates far more than just the movement. It controls coordination, decision-making, focus, emotional regulation, fatigue perception, and also recovery. So, like, in high performance environments, the difference between athletes in general is not just their physical capacity, but it's how efficiently their brain processes pressure, how it adapts under the stress, and how it executes that skill, sometimes automatically and sometimes with a lot of cognition to be able to then know exactly where their body is in space and time. From a neuroscience perspective, elite performance relies on really efficient neural pathways developed through repetition and experience. And the brain becomes better the more you do it at predicting movement and filtering the distractions and making more rapid decisions under fatigue. So an example of that would be to deliver something as simple as what's called a strip task, which is a go, no-go task, like a brain training application while they're under fatigue. What that actually does is kind of hits a really specific area of the brain that athletes need to make decisions while they're under fatigue. And then from that, we look at an eye, then you ask them questions about their thoughts and actions during that time, because it's not actually the brain training that works, is how they see and perceive the stresses of that during that time. So it's not the actual game that's doing anything, but what's in the field studies from my side, it's how the athlete actually undergoes that stressor in a really highly cognitively fatigued state in general. So yeah, that's one of the things that I do. That was as an example, without going into really super technical too much for your listeners. Yes.
Yeah. And you mentioned elite performance, but does this also apply to some extent to amateur athletes, dedicated athletes, but that are not at the world-class level that most of your clients are at?
The answer to that is yes, because everyone's brain structure is very similar. Elite athletes may be better at some portions of doing activities or at better and faster cognition while they're doing it. That doesn't mean that that non-elite athletes can't get better at it. So again, that neural plasticity, what is a really big buzzword going around at the moment, what neuroplasticity actually is, that's just really changing the way that your brain reacts to situations. And that can be positive and negative. So brain plasticity itself is not actually something that's inherently positive, which you hear a lot on social media these days, that brain plasticity is a good thing. Not necessarily, not if you're highly anxious about something. So that you can train your brain into being highly anxious. So brain plasticity is positive and negative. It just means changing of the brain. So yeah, can you do it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I heard an interesting theory on a podcast some time ago about the brain and carbohydrates. So cycling, mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say, is your main sport that you've been working a lot in. Mm-hmm. And in cycling, it's in the last years, the carbohydrate revolution, so to say, has really been making waves, and we have lots of cyclists that are habitually taking, well, at least 120 grams an hour, but some of them are taking well above that number. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we have physiological studies that show that you're not really oxidizing more exogenous carbohydrates, and it might not even be sparing muscle glycogen. Yet, I think everybody who has tried this and coaches know that like performance does seem to improve. Mm-hmm. And the theory that I heard was that, well, the brain is a big consumer of carbohydrate. And what are your thoughts on that? Could that be a reason for the carbohydrates working at this new higher level?
Potentially, yes. But also there's a neural pathway between your tongue and your brain that doesn't care whether you get carbohydrates or not, as long as it's sweet. You can change the cognition of your brain if it just thinks that it's about to get more carbohydrate. So there's a placebo effect in that too. As long as your brain thinks that you're getting carbohydrate, the cognition will be better. But to continue on your line of questioning, do I think that the neural pathways get better and more efficient at muscle firing with more glycogen or more glucose? Yes, I do.
Yeah,
not for dispute.
And that would be the theory that even though you're not sparing muscle glycogen and you're not even oxidizing all of that extra glucose, but the reason that you're seeing the performance improvement is that the neural pathways are managing to keep firing like for longer in a long endurance event like a bike race.
Yes, but also if we're going back to a non-elite standpoint, they're using so much carbohydrate because of the amount of power that they're actually putting out, and the actual output and heat exchange is so much more than a non-elite athlete. So for a non-elite athlete to say, I need 180 grams like some professional triathletes do at the moment per hour, all that's going to do is more than likely give you gastrointestinal distress in general, because you're not actually outputting that much as well. So again, there's a social media push towards how much professional athletes do, And that doesn't necessarily, there needs to be a percentage of that, I think. That's my thought process on that, at least anyway.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I've never advised any amateur athletes to go higher than 120 at most. And even 120, you need to be a fairly decent amateur athlete, I think, because if your output is very low, then even at that point, 90 is still, in my mind, a good sort of cap and a good target for longer events. But we're on a bit of a sidetrack there, and that's my fault. So I'll bring us back to the brain here. I guess, so thinking about amateur athletes, mm-hmm. the one thing that is different is the amount of perhaps external stress and fatigue, cognitive fatigue that they have mm-hmm. from their job and even other responsibilities that a lot of elite athletes don't have. How do you see this impacting amateur athletes' ability to perform, whether it's in training or in racing? And is this something that we can somehow, are there interventions that we can use to try to minimize the negative impact of these other stressors?
So there's a concept in physiology in general called allostatic load, and it's the amount of load external to performance-based structure that it is. So it's children, it's relationships, it's work, it's all of the extra stuff that you have to do that's non-performance related. Yeah, so that allostatic load is so much higher in an amateur athlete than what it is in a professional athlete, because they have time to recover, and their job, excuse me, is to just produce performance. Their key performance indicator in general is output. And that's sort of sometimes on a world stage, sometimes not. But from an amateur level, your key performance metrics should be health mostly. So what is it? What is it that makes you happy? And do you deliver that to yourself when it comes to I've gone off on a tangent myself here, but can you deliver a outcome because you're far more highly stressed than an elite athlete on a day-to-day level, I would say. Yes.
And what are some things that this is a fact that we can't really change. We have the responsibilities we have, but are there some things that we can do to minimize the negative impact on what we still want to do in terms of our sport, our pursuits of endurance performance?
Yeah, you can actually. So dopamine and serotonin are two of the happy chemicals. They actually come out when you do exercise in general. They mediate the amount of cortisol that's in your brain, which will make you happier. You'll get the endorphins and all the rest of it. So just doing exercise itself removes a lot of the stresses of the allostatic load in general. So as long as you get the recovery enough to adapt to the physiological performance that you want or the output, then any exercise in general is going to help you removing that overall stressor. Yes.
Yeah. That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, personally, I noticed that some days I leave my training for the end of the work day because I don't know how mm-hmm. long it will take me to get through everything that I have to do. And then when I get to the training, I'm already very stressed, and I always feel like I perform worse, even though it's not about, it's not that I am necessarily more physiologically primed in the morning than in the afternoon. I think the opposite might be true, but it's just that stress buildup. And whereas in the doing exercise in the morning, then it's basically the opposite. It removes some stress, so I already start the workday with a lower baseline of stress, it feels like, even though before doing the exercise I feel more stressed because, oh, I'm going out and doing this run, even though I have so much work on my plate and I don't even know if I'm going to be able to finish it. But it tends to work out better that way anyway. So yeah, that's even just a personal example that came to mind.
From a musculoskeletal point of view too, most of the time you would be sitting down for the majority of the day then getting up and doing exercise. Mm. So that the fact that you're sitting or not moving in general is going to change the way that your physical output's being delivered.
Mm. Yeah,
So after work and before work exercise is going to be different. And if you understand the reasons why that happens, then you can actually get through the session probably a little bit better. It's like, where am I in the day? Where is my stress? And what's my output? And what does a good session look like, which may be different from a Saturday or a Sunday or a Tuesday afternoon or a Thursday night after you've taken your daughter to dancing or something like that? You know, like, it's going to be different as an amateur athlete because of where you are in life. So if you understand where you are in life, so have that self-regulation and self-efficacy of where you are in space and time and how much overall load that you have. So then from that, what do I need to get specifically out of the session that I'm about to do? If it's a non-essential session, then what do I need to do to have the most amount of fun? Because that's what I'm doing this activity for in the first place. But if it's a targeted session, it's like, okay, then what do I need to do to be able to then engage myself enough to be able to deliver?
Yeah. That's a good point, and there is a tension there between the idea that as amateur athletes we're more time limited anyway, so you kind of want to make every session count in some way. That doesn't mean every session should be intense, but it's easy to fall into that line of thinking that every time you go out and do something you need to do. It needs to be really focused. You need to work with like really high quality for whatever it is you're doing. But your point there as well is that, well, in many of the non-essential sessions, maybe what really makes the session count is having fun, because that way you can reduce the negative impact of that allostatic load.
Yeah, but also from an elite level, it's unobtainable for every elite athlete session to be great as well. Right.
Yeah.
So why do we think that as an amateur I need to do every single session has to be perfect? It doesn't.
Yeah, because we're trying to compensate the lack of hours with more quality.
Yeah. And from an elite level, it's like, I do this for a living, it has to be great. Like, why am I even doing it? But where you're coming at is from two totally different spots. It's exactly the same perfectionism trait. Trait perfectionism is what you really need is to be as precise as possible given where you are in space and time. That's it.
What does that mean, to be as precise as possible?
Just do the session of as well as you can given all of the characteristics that you have as you start that session. Doesn't that, if you can't get through that session, then understand that that's not going to be the difference between you winning and losing. It's actually going to be the difference between you recovering better or not if you push through.
And how does one move away from the perfectionist traits that I think lots of us have?
That's the reason why sport's amazing, because it brings out the traits that you need to work on in general. So how you get through the perfectionism piece is, again, understanding, which is the self-regulation piece that we were talking about before, is understanding where your body is both mentally and physically at any given time throughout your physical effort, pretty much. It's like, can I do this, yes or no? And if it's no, why can't I do it, and is that acceptable to me?
I'm very biased here, but I think that this is where a good coach comes in, and somebody like you. Like, it doesn't have to be a coach even, but somebody that knows you. And it is hard, because to some extent perfectionism can take you in the beginning. It can be, while perfectionist might not be perfect, it can help you, because it also comes with a certain drive that helps you become a good endurance athlete.
100%.
But then it starts hurting you, can start hurting you at a certain point as well.
Yes, but you, almost everyone in this case, and I've yet to see someone who's perfect at anything, you make compensations for something throughout the day.
Mm. Yeah, so, like what?
So it could be anything. So you've made compensations about the amount of time that you're spending at work because you need to go and do a session, or you're making conversation of, I'm taking time away from my family because I need to do athletic performance or whatever it is, you are making conversations throughout your entire existence. So why aren't you allowing yourself those compensations when it comes to actually delivering what you think is a perfect session?
Yeah. Big thanks to our sponsor, Precision Fuel Hydration. If you've ever struggled with your fueling hydration strategy, Precision make it simple with products that are designed around real-world athletic needs and applications and backed by science. They do amazing gels like the PF30 and PF90, plus the caffeinated version of the PF30 for an extra kick. They also have the Flow Gel that holds 300 grams of carbohydrates. You can have a big amount of carbs in just one bottle without having to mix various gels into water. And on the hydration side, they offer drink mixes and multi-strength electrolytes tailored to how much sodium you lose in your sweat, and sodium capsules for a quick and easy top-up of sodium. Best of all, they have a free fuel and hydration planner that you can use to get a personalized strategy tailored to your event, your sweat profile, and more. So check it all out at precisionfuelhydration.com. And as a TTS listener, you get 15% off your first order with the code TTS2026. What about within racing itself? In what ways does the brain play a role there with things like decision making, and how can athletes work on those factors?
So first of all, you kind of have to look at what decision making actually is, because the brain makes thousands of mini decisions every second, pretty much. So how can an athlete, how can an athlete change their decisions on race day?
Improve their decision making. For example, decision making, I would say pacing would be a big one, but also nutrition, hydration decisions, and dealing with unexpected situations that come up on the race course. Those sorts of things.
First of all, calm is fast when it comes to that part. As soon as you feel as though you're out of control, it takes some time to be able to get back into that control piece. So pacing in general is all about duration, path, and outcome analysis. So how long you think that you can do something for the level of effort, and how and what's the outcome? Can I do it? Yes or no? That's what pacing is, pretty much. From a really broken down level. And if your brain thinks that you can't sustain the effort or it's not a viable option for the amount of time that you need to do it, the perception of effort goes up, and therefore your delivery and the efficiency of firing the muscle goes down as a result. So again, calm decision from that. And allowing the breath is one. Doing those fatigued-based brain training exercises, again, is understanding why and how your body reacts the way that it does and why it's feeling the way that it does under fatigue, again, is another really big training piece that comes into pacing. Because if you understand where your body and why your body's thinking and behaving the way that it is, you make higher quality decisions a lot more often.
So the fatigue-based brain training exercise, was that the, did you call it the strip test?
Yeah, one of them is a strip test. There's lots of different ones, and but the strip task is one. It's really easily available. There's lots of games on the app stores that people can do.
Can you explain
So there's a word pretty much that's on the screen, and the word is a color. So it will be red, and it'd be in red writing would be one version of it, and another version of it would be red with in green coloring, but the actual correct response is green because we're looking for the color of the word, not the word itself. So your brain changes the way that it takes longer for what's called the incongruent task, which is the red in green writing, than what it does if it just goes, oh, that's red, if that makes sense.
I have done one of these tests, I remember now.
Yeah. So that's just one version. There's lots of different decision-making tasks that look at concentration levels, that look at like attention, that look at task switching. There's lots of training exercises depending on what you're actually deficient in, I should say.
How much would you need to commit to when you know what you're deficient in and which task or test or game is the best suited for you? Mm-hmm. I guess that it might depend, but with the strip task, for example, how often would you do something like that, and for how long a period to see results?
So strip tasks are really good in pacing, for pacing, because it's a go no go. It's kind of what it does in scientific papers. After a set of intervals, I do one, and then it'll last for anywhere between a minute and 3 minutes total, which is usually the recovery piece anyway. If you're not interested in taking your own lactates and all the rest of the things that you may need to do after an interval set. Maybe 3 minutes of that every, depending on how many sets you do, up to five times a session. And an understanding where if you're getting angry or if you're getting frustrated or whatever it is within that task, ask yourself why you're doing that, and then how do I calm myself to be able to deliver? Because you're going to make mistakes in that task. You're going to make mistakes, and it's how you then move on from those mistakes to do the next bits as well as possible. That also is a really big factor in what decision making and pacing actually delivers, especially in endurance activity.
And let's say you do this, you have a couple of interval sessions per week, and you do this in how many weeks does it take for you to actually see an effect, or let's say for a study to be able to show an effect on an outcome measure, whatever outcome measure?
Oh, for a study to do it, it's pre and post. You can see a difference.
Immediately after one session?
Yeah, you can see a difference, but it's again, we're not looking at the outcome of that task. You're actually looking at how you deliver that task.
That's what I mean. Like how long until doing that.
I misunderstood your question. Yeah. I apologize. So how long, that's a very individualized concept. I've seen some athletes that I've worked this that get it, get an understanding a lot better within two sessions, but I have others it takes 2 months, 3 months.
And doing this, it sounds very similar to the concept of brain endurance training. Can you explain what are the differences? For listeners that don't know brain endurance training, can you explain what that is and how is it different from what you're describing?
So brain endurance training actually looks to train the neural pathways specifically that act in decision making and under fatigue, that trains the neural pathways. What you're looking for in this type of training is actually it hits exactly the same pathways, but it's actually how your body delivers that over time. That's the only difference in all honesty. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
I've never seen an effect of overall endurance activity being increased by brain endurance training in the field.
Mm. Yeah, because it was, I actually remember it was one of the very first episodes I did on this podcast 9 years ago was with Samuele Marcora, who I think is kind of the inventor of the whole concept.
Yeah.
And I think around that time it was a pretty hot topic in the academic world, but I don't think it's so researched as much or talked about at least as much now. So maybe it's faded away a bit.
So he does, his stuff was in slightly different. So he looked at how perceived effort works in overall training, his roles in cognitive fatigue, pretty much. Mm. So Macora's work is seminal when it comes to brain endurance training, pretty much. But he works in overall cognitive fatigue and how to reduce that cognitive fatigue over time. That's what he's looking at.
Okay, so, okay. Yeah. And is that something that you use? You're reducing cognitive fatigue, and how would you work on that if you have an athlete that needs to do that?
I don't work on that piece because in overall racing in general, we try to minimize overall cognitive load in all aspects. It actually doesn't matter because the research is there that any cognitive fatigue will increase perceived effort and decrease overall endurance activity.
Right. So you're working on reducing cognitive load leading up to the race.
That if you can do that for any athlete, doesn't matter what level, the overall cognitive fatigue. If you can reduce cognitive load for the time frame before a really high level race. So in the Tour de France, as an example. If you reduce the cognitive load in the first 2 weeks of an athlete, they have more, their perceived effort goes down. We've seen this over the last few years. In the third week, they have more capacity to be able to deliver.
And how do you do that? How do you reduce the cognitive load or fatigue from the first 2 weeks?
So you change their social media profiles. You change the way that they're seen in the media, so their media commitments, all of the stuff. So how the team then delivers and works around their number one athlete, doesn't matter who it is, to reduce overall pressure in general, then helps them in the third week.
So do you think it is a big advantage to not wear yellow, like if you're fighting for the yellow jersey, for example, but you have a relative unknown wearing yellow and you're just 1 second behind on GC, let's say you're Tadej Pogacar or you're Jonas Vingegaard, but you wait until the third week or the end of the second week to actually get the jersey because you don't have to do so much media. Is that a genuine advantage for the third week?
100% yes, because it's not just a cognitive load, it's a physiological load on you and the team at the same time in the defense. So you don't have to do any work in the first 200 kilometers of a stage.
Yeah.
Well, you do if you're in the yellow. So yeah. Yes. Yeah. So yeah, physiologically and cognitively, 100%, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah, yeah. And about social media, so you said change the files, but are athletes basically, would there be a case for just saying a blanket statement, no social media for any athletes during the Tour de France? Or is that something that can have more negative consequences in some ways for some athletes?
It removes autonomy from the athlete and therefore I don't like it. Mm. So I think you can give them recommendations to say either remove it from your phone or just use it via laptop or whichever. You know, that you actually need to go into a social media profile or whatever, or hand off that overall profile to a trusted individual, which happens quite a lot these days now. But yeah, so yes, the answer to that is I don't think you should remove the autonomy of an athlete, that there shouldn't be a team that says you shouldn't do something. Like when it comes to their own autonomy, especially with their own profile, they're independent contractors, but there definitely should be recommendations. Yes.
Yeah. Do you think there are other things that's happening in the world of cycling, especially where a lot of things are very detail oriented from the amount of the grams of carbohydrates and protein and fat that they eat for dinner and breakfast and all of that to maybe that's the main one that I'm thinking of, where like the team basically has a lot to say about what's going on with the athlete, not just in the race, but outside of the race. Is that the kind of thing that, what I'm getting at is, do you think that there is still a restriction of autonomy of athletes that can be stressful for some athletes? Or is this maybe something that has improved in the last few years compared to perhaps 10, 20 years ago? And now there is a bit more autonomy for athletes.
I think it depends on what name's on your t-shirt. I think there's very much different teams go about it in a totally different manner. And a lot of the time, what you think is happening is not, it's either not as bad as what you think it is, or it's not as good as what you think it is. There's a range there. There's athletes that I'm quite sure the general public think that they'd weigh every gram of food and weigh, you know, up to what a grain of rice, and I've seen 100% that they could not care less. And there's others that you think that don't. Absolutely, don't drink diet cola because, you know, whatever, for whatever reason. So, yeah, there's a range when it comes to teams. Yes,
yeah,
very much so.
What about amateur athletes and cognitive load? What are some ways that you would advise an amateur athlete reducing their cognitive load leading into an important race?
That one's far more difficult and far more complex because there's families involved and there's lots of other aspects rather than from an elite athlete perspective, they're paid to do what they're about to do. So the issues there is you could actually be a little bit more forthright. But when it comes to from a non-elite level, again, get some joy in your life. Like find joy, find happiness, find whatever it is. That's actually the best mediator of overall stressor is happiness, laughter, doing things that you love. Those type of things are the best minimizer of cognitive load that you can have. So it seems really, really simple, but the brain doesn't care. Your brain does not care where you're getting your joy from or what it is, but the biggest minimizer of overall cortisol is happiness.
Is that the main effect that happens in the brain, a reduction in cortisol, or are there other effects as well?
Yeah, the biggest mediator is overall, is the easiest way to put it is joy, happiness.
Is this something... Let's say you have somebody, they're going to do the Ironman World Championships, an amateur athlete. And so is this something that, at what point do they need, would you like them, or would it be behoove them to be very conscious about this? Is it 1 week out from the race, 2 weeks out from the race? Is it more of a chronic thing, or is it something that you can have most of the effects in a very acute sense if you start to think about it a few days before the race? Obviously, it's always nice to be happy. So maybe it should be a chronic thing. But
yeah, so I believe it's a chronic thing.
Hmm.
Yeah, so happiness is a recovery tool. Doing things that give you joy, that could be sitting on the couch and watching a movie. If that gives you joy and that's a part of your recovery, do that. Yeah, that means that the next session will be better as a result.
Hmm. I was going to ask, are there things that, like social media, for example, that it might seem to give, for some people, it might seem to give them joy, does it really? Like, are there things like that, you know, if the first thing you think about, what do I want to do? Because that's a different question. I want to do something that makes me happy, or I want to do something that, like, I want to do, and social media, reaching for your phone is maybe a simple response, but that is not necessarily what makes you happy. My question, I guess, is, or you maybe already know, but what my question is, so go on.
Very, very short term, like, benefits, super short term. That's the reason why they're addictive, because it's color and movement, and your brain loves it.
It's dopamine.
Your brain loves color and movement. It loves new things and what other people are doing.
Yeah, and that's what makes it seem to some extent like you're happy. Are there other things than that? Because if watching a movie is okay, so that and I like that intuitively that makes sense to me because it's also something that is more like longer attention span, and for some reason it makes sense that. But what are there other things than social media that you think these are things that might seem like good choices for people to reduce that stress and get a bit of joy, but that are not good ideas to actually choose when it comes to getting that reduction in cortisol that we're wanting to have.
So being around people who you have a bond with as well, that releases what's called oxytocin, and there's other chemicals around that as well. But being around people that you enjoy their company, does not matter what you do, that also is a really good recovery piece I even tell my elite athletes exactly that. If you're a loner, go and go for a walk. Go and be by yourself for a little bit at the same time. You know, if you enjoy your own company, I have had a yellow jersey, a person who was in the yellow jersey a couple of years ago at the Tour de France, his first time he'd been in the yellow jersey. He was so overwhelmed with the fact that that had happened to him that all he wanted was to be by himself for a bit. So I got him to go out of the hotel room at 6:30 in the morning and just go for a walk and sit on a park bench by himself. Because it's the only time he'd been by himself for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So
and was he more of an introvert or
yeah, but he just needed time. He just needed time. Like everything was overwhelming to him. So from that, it's like, okay, I know this is what I like about myself. This is what I need to be able to calm myself down in these situations and reduce my overall cognitive load and to feel as though I'm myself again.
Yeah.
I need to be by myself a bit. So, okay, then why can't you go and do that? Who cares if you're in the Tour de France? Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So that's,
Makes sense.
Another example. Yeah. Like, again, if you understand the self, if you have really good self-efficacy and you're confident about yourself, it's like, okay, this is what I know. This is what I know that I need to make me happy, to find some joy or to make me calm and in control. If you're feeling overwhelmed, what do I need to go to get back that homeostasis, to get back that level playing field that you kind of know you're where you need to be?
Yeah.
And if you're a non-elite athlete, that's sometimes quite difficult to do. I understand that. And I'm married with two children, and I know that there's demands on everyone's life in general, but a couple of minutes or, you know, up to an hour, you know, like go for a run, go for a swim, go for, you know, jump on Zwift for a little bit, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If combine this with where we kind of started with, like the training that should, the non-essential training that you really want to make you happy, then you're basically killing two birds in one stone there.
Yeah. And it should be that, shouldn't it? Like not every session that you do needs to be a session that you feel as though that you've gone to the well or you've gone over capacity each time.
Yeah.
Like that's a recipe for overall fatigue, not just and increased injury risk, not just physiologically, like psychologically at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm also thinking that I think that one is more like easy for most people to avoid because I think most people, but at least most listeners of this podcast, know that you shouldn't train hard every single session because it's not sustainable. But I think the one that is a bit more less intuitive, I guess, is that the sessions that are not hard, like sometimes you can just go out and, you know, don't look at your watch, your pace, your heart rate or anything. Just go out and ride. Just go out and run. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to always do something. You don't have to always do strides. You don't have to always do like some cadence drills on the bike or things like that. Sometimes it's just about going out and enjoying being on the bike, enjoying running, enjoying swimming, those sort of things.
So to give you an example of that, I had a world champion mountain biker that was struggling to get lucky. They were the world champion going into the next world championship. So they were finding it very difficult to finish sessions and a really high overall load metric. And one of the sessions that they went to do was just a 4.5 hour ride. So what I got this person to do was to find me 5 things that they'd never seen before on that road, on the roads that they always train on. They'd never seen before because most of the time they're too busy looking at a head unit. So I got them to take photos, send them to me, and it's just what made, like, I didn't even know, like, one of the things was I didn't even know a whole house was there beforehand. She'd never seen it before.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's funny, especially for a mountain biker, because I think that one of the things that attracts people to mountain biking is that connection to the environment and to being in nature. And
true. But at the highest level, it's still all about performance, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it, maybe she, maybe, or he or she, they might have had that in the beginning, but then as you get more and more success, you get more and more sucked into that, like constantly trying to chase something and the perfectionist tendencies like we
talked about. Yeah, so how do we go back to why you actually started?
Yeah.
Why did you start the activity in the first place? Because you enjoyed it, right?
Yeah.
Or there was something about it that you wanted to be better at whatever activity that you were doing, whether that's triathlon, whether it's running, whether it's racing cars. That part doesn't matter. You wanted to be better or better than somebody else at this, to be the best possible. But that's if that's the enjoyment, that's fine. But find the enjoyment. And if you're not getting that enjoyment, then that motivation goes down so fast, it's not funny.
Mm. Yeah. We talked about, I'm going to take another question actually, because we talked about quite a few challenges and problems here. Is there anything important that we haven't talked about yet? Any common issues you see with athletes you're working with and that would be helpful for the listeners to hear about and a bit how you can overcome them?
Common issues in general that I see, and I don't work with non-elite athletes, so this is a purely professional sport piece, is there, again, I'm going to go again, self-efficacy and self-regulation. So self-efficacy is your belief in your ability to be able to perform at a level, whatever designated level that you do, slightly different to confidence. It's more nuanced than confidence. It is specifically to that targeted activity. They struggle with that in the first place. So they don't think that they can do something that everything else is pointing towards that they can. Yeah. So that's a big one. And the second one is self-regulation piece, is knowing why your body is behaving, your brain's thinking that's where the body is in space and time. So that's how self-regulation is your ability to be able to monitor and manage thoughts and behaviors, and then how they then get projected onto others. Like some people are.
What is an example of that? Can you give an example of that?
Being oblivious to, I don't know, the sound that brushing your teeth makes in a hotel room when you're rooming with someone at the Tour de France. Which may cause some severe anger issues to both parties because they're both tired. Or you not understanding, or you're not understanding is the wrong word. You don't have the ability to regulate the signals in general that. I'm struggling to find an example here. Why you're behaving the way that you are? So why have you quit a session? Say they're from before. So there you go. Why have I quit a session before? And then if you don't understand that, all of a sudden you're terrible at whatever activity that you're doing. Your confidence goes down, motivation goes down. But if you take a step back and look and say, oh, hang on a minute, I didn't get any sleep last night because my 2-year-old child was up vomiting or whatever, or I didn't, if you understand the reasons why, that self-regulation piece becomes easier to be able to adapt within your overall performance in general, from that part. So the biggest issues are those two. So the self-efficacy piece, which is, comes into confidence, is slightly nuanced. So lack of, most of the time, lack of self-efficacy. And then also lack of self-regulation at the same time.
So, and how would you, and I can confirm, by the way, as somebody working with amateur athletes, that at least lack of self-efficacy is super common, or I see that super commonly. And I think the self-regulation piece is maybe a bit less frequent, but definitely something that
it's definitely that I see. Like 100% would be there, because the self-regulation part is they would not understand why they can't do something, and they should be able to do it.
Right. Yeah.
They should be able to do it. So they'd come back to you and go, "I've done this session 20 times before, and I don't know why I couldn't do it," or whatever it is. That's the self-regulation part. It's like, well, and all of a sudden they come back heightened, and it's you're the one that's the issue. Like, as a coach, they come back on the coach and what have you done to me? You're not doing this properly. Like, when, in all honesty, they're not giving you all of the feedback that you need to be able to then change the session, because you would have if you knew that they didn't have sleep last night, or they didn't, you know, or they didn't get a chance, that they were up too late working, so they didn't have. Yeah, didn't have dinner. They didn't fuel themselves, and but there's a myriad of different things. So,
and how do you improve your self efficacy and your self regulation?
The self efficacy piece is actually just, again, knowing where you are in space and time, understanding where, taking that 500-foot view and just go, why is this happening to me? Why do I act the way that I do in this specific thing? Why?
Is that self-efficacy or self-regulation?
So self-regulation. Did I say
you said self-efficacy.
So my apologies. And from the self-efficacy piece is, if we look at the session again, I should be able to do this, right? I have the ability to do this. Do you? Yeah, it's a yes or no question most of the time. Do I have the ability to do it? Yes or no? So the self-efficacy piece is, if I can do it and I can't do it, why do I, you know, what is it around it that I can't do it? Why not? And then delivering that to whatever platform, or whether it's a coach, whether it's your husband, whether it's your partner, whether it's your wife, whether it's your children, it's like, okay, this is where I am at the moment. I'm okay with it, if that makes sense.
What about ahead of races? Because that's where I think that a lot of times, like that, or maybe it manifests more, but that a lack of self-efficacy, not so much in the day-to-day of training, but coming into a race, feeling like the training is not enough that they've done. And a race is different because you haven't done the whole race in training. You've done a lot of training that will prepare you for the race, but you can't know for sure whether you will finish your Ironman or your Olympic distance triathlon in your goal time, because you haven't actually done it. Maybe you've done it previous seasons or in previous races, but you haven't done it in the current training block, let's say.
So your brain is really good at creating safety for you, which is the what if, right? So what it's actually doing in this case is saying to you, I'm giving you an out, I'm giving you a safety mechanism to say, if I don't do this, I'm still going to be okay. So, of course, your brain is going to go to places of what if. It has to, because you've created an emotional attachment to an outcome in general. And it's going to be more heightened the more emotionally attached you are to whatever outcome that you have. Like, it becomes that the signaling becomes stronger. And again, that neuroplasticity will change as a result of it as well. So how you regulate your emotions in that time frame is really highly important, really highly important. And again, going back to why do I feel this way, and is it okay? And if it's too much, what do I need to do to remove myself from a situation and to create some calm?
In many situations, I have suggested athletes look at their two best swims, two best bikes, and two best runs that they've done in a training period leading up to a race, and also keep, or at least keep one of each in mind, one swim that felt really good and one bike that felt really good and one run that felt really good on each of those legs of the race, so that if you start to doubt yourself, you can always bring it back to that moment where you know that you felt really good in yourself and felt that self-efficacy as well. So yeah, I just want to run that by you if you think that's a decent strategy.
The answer to that is yes, because what that does is create schemas in your brain. So what you're doing is bringing back a really core memory and then creating efficient pathways to be able to deliver whatever that performance is.
So
perfect. It's exactly the right thing to do. So what do I need to do to, again, can I do it? Yes. Create calm by saying, have I done this before? Yeah, I have. I'm not going to forget to ride a bike. I'm not going to forget how to run. It may be difficult, but I have done it before and I am good enough to be able to deliver because I've done it before. So again, bringing back that memory, coming back into that removing of that fight or flight response into more of a calming area.
We're coming up on time here, so I'm just going to ask one more question. I think you're not the most the most productive in terms of producing social media and content for people. Although, so thank you so much for taking part in this podcast interview. But what I will want to ask you is, instead of following you, because that's probably not going to be so useful for people, are there some resources related to the topics we've been talking about today that you would recommend people look up if they're interested and want to learn more?
So Sam McCora stuff's really good. In all honesty, his science is really robust and it's great. When it comes to what else have we talked about?
We've talked about the most recent thing was self-efficacy and self-regulation. Before that, we talked about the importance of happiness, reducing cortisol.
From the happiness perspective, there's lots of athletes, the professional athletes are really good in this content creation space. When it comes to the joy and happiness, Chelsea's one, Sodaro. I don't work with her anymore, but I have in the past. She's really good at focusing on joy. Kate Courtney's another one that's really good at finding the joy within her external space at the same time. Resources, there's lots. Like literally, I'd Google it if I'm totally honest. The way that AI is at the moment, there's probably a question in and around that at some stage as well, maybe for a different podcast. But there's lots of really good AI that comes to how do I create better self-regulation for myself given these factors. And it will give you a good enough, not perfect, but good enough examples of that resource. Resources are really readily available these days. So I suggest reading as much as possible because education is king.
I don't know, you probably just read the original research, but are you aware of any like popular science book on these topics that you would recommend?
I think Alex Hutchinson's done one.
Endure.
That's it. Yes. There is some others too. Alistair Brownlee had a good book too. Al Brownlee's good one. There's a new book. I don't know what that's called either.
I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. I also think Matt Fitzgerald has.
He does too. Yes,
has one or a couple of.
I was forgetting that
right.
Name. But
thank you.
I'll get my PA to send you some science papers to be able to.
Put that all in the show notes. Amazing. Thank you so much, David. Will you be at the Tour de France this summer?
The last week I will be, but I'll be in America for Tom Evans for Hard Rock.
The
first couple of weeks. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck with that and with all of the other athletes and everything you're working with. And thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you very much. And I think we've left some things open for the possibility of something else.
Yes, sounds good. Right, take care. I hope that you enjoyed that interview. Before we go for today, I want to take a minute of your time and ask you for a couple of favors that will make a massive difference for me and for that triathlon show. And number one here is share the podcast. You probably know other triathletes or endurance athletes that could benefit from this type of content, but are not yet regular listeners, or maybe they might never have heard about the podcast. So it really would make a massive difference if you could share this episode or share the episode that you think that your friends, training partners, squad members would enjoy the most and benefit the most from. And it might seem insignificant to share with just one person, for example, but it really does make a massive difference over time, spread out across all of our listeners. So please do this if you can. It means a great deal to me, and it costs nothing to do so. I asked this last week as well, and already had several people email me saying that they had shared, and I really appreciate that. Thank you so much to all of you who did that. And the second thing that you can do to support the podcast is to support our partners, Ruvi Effortless Swimming and Precision Fuel and Hydration. These are amazing products that I use. I really believe in them, and they are amazing brands with amazing people behind them. So please consider using these brands for your virtual cycling, for your swim goggles, and for your nutrition and hydration products of choice. And you can find discount codes in the episode description. Now, one more thing. The racing season is properly started now in the Northern Hemisphere. It has been going on for a while, of course, in North America. But now we're really getting ramped up in Europe as well. And North America is also really ramping up with more races coming thick and fast. It's not too late to start training if you feel that you're a bit behind, and you can still make a big difference to your season by getting on some really good structured training now. Even if you're close to racing or you feel that there's not enough time. So check out our coaching and training plan options on scientifictriathlon.com, and you can also email me to learn more. For coaching, if you are interested in that, you'll always have a free discovery call before committing to anything. And we also have no minimum commitment term. So we try to remove all of the risk or the perceived risk that I know that people might see in signing up for coaching. And please don't hesitate to reach out and ask questions, and we can discuss whether coaching is right for you or not. Recently, I want to say we've been specializing almost in course-correcting athletes who've been using various triathlon and endurance-specific AI platforms, as well as generic LLMs to guide their training. And that's been quite interesting, an interesting experience. If you are using a platform like this and you're not progressing like you want to, I can almost guarantee that you're not the problem. It's the training that you're getting that is the problem. So reach out and we can discuss how to fix that as well. That's it for this week. We'll be back next Thursday with another episode. And in the meantime, thank you as always for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.